a bit of fun to bring in the new year, we talk with Jennifer Yeh Nelson about Kung Fu Panda 2 on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast.
Save it. Take the five. It is time for the next phase of your journey.
My fist hungers for justice. That was my fist.
We need to get to that tower without being spotted by those wolves.
Huh?
Got it. Stealth mode.
I hate this sneaking around.
How can Kung Fu stop something that stops Kung Fu?
Here we go!
Remember, Dragon Warrior, when you follow the noble path, anything is possible.
I'm freaking in.
Ah, my old enemy. Stairs.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons. Happy New Year, and welcome to this somewhat special episode of MMP. I've got an interview with Jennifer Yeh Nelson, director of Kung Fu Panda 2. The film took its lumps when it was released last spring, and really, it shouldn't have. It's a martial arts comedy that truly takes the spirit of such Hong Kong masters as Jackie Chan and wraps it up in the rich DreamWorks animation style. It was great in 3D and should be just as good in two dimensions. Yeah, I really like this film. Felt it was unjustly dismissed last year, and with the home video release last month, I'm delighted to have the chance to reintroduce it to you now. So, have a listen to the interview, and here we go. I wanted to ask you, first off, is there any type of philosophy or theory that DreamWorks applies in general to the use of 3D? Because it strikes me that the way it's deployed in DreamWorks animated films in general is quite effective. Are there any operating principles?
Well, it certainly changes from film to film because everybody's learning as we go. But one thing that we really tried to do was make sure that it was an immersive experience. It's not like a gimmicky thing where something's popping out at your eyeballs all the time, which is kind of what people maybe think about with old 3D or bad 3D. But when you're dealing with film and dealing with an extra dimension in film, it really can make you feel like you're there. And that's one of the things that we really tried to do during the process of making this. And it's not added on at the end either. It's part of every step of the process.
Can you give me an example of how it got applied to Kung Fu Panda?
Well, for instance, some of the fight sequences, of course, being Kung Fu action fight sequences, 3D really lends itself to that, because if a character is leaping off a building or about to fall off a building or something like that, you really can feel the space of these sets. And you'll notice that in scenes like when Po and the Five are leaping up the tower, the bad guy's tower, that sequence is really, really depthy. And it makes you feel the vertigo of them doing something quite death-defying. But on top of that, even in the choir sequences, we use it in a much more subtle way. Like in the bad guy's main room, on top of the tower, this room with all these columns, and it's all marble and reflective. We thought about how the depth would look in reflections on the marble on the floor to make it feel real, and made sure that it was how you would experience marble in real life. So it gives you that luxurious feel of seeing that real texture in the real environment, and also makes you feel what it's like for Poe when he's coming into the bad guy's face.
This is sort of a wayward question, but I'm just curious, how much time did it take to develop the explosive plumes that came out of those cannons? Because I don't think I've seen an effect like that before.
It definitely took a while, because we have an excellent effects team. They're just rabidly excellent. And one of the things they try to do is get an explosion that not only was beautiful, but different. And Ramon was looking for a stylized realism, too. It wasn't, it's not like an exact realistic explosion. The whole world is stylized. Every effect in it is stylized. You'll see shapes in all the smoke plumes. And they, in particular, the cannon explosion is meant to look like the tail of a peacock. And that takes probably more work than just doing a random explosion. So we had quite a while, months and months of just R&D of looking at beautiful explosions and trying to get the perfect balance between stylized and believable. And ultimately, it was based on fireworks, not on an actual, you know, explosion. So it's more beautiful. The colors were meant to be a little bit more fantastical than straight fire.
So you are given the opportunity to do the sequel. You're given basically the setup of the, good old friendly, cuddly Jack Black Poe. Where did you want to take the film past this, and what did you do to move it into that direction?
Well, certainly in the first film, we get to meet everybody. And you only get so much time in a movie. You get maximum of maybe 90 minutes to really get to know all these people and go through an adventure with them. So you barely get to meet Paul in the first one. He barely gets into that world of kung fu and barely gets some skills by the end of the movie. And the sequel, we wanted to make sure that we got to meet the characters and understand them more deeply, understand what their history is, their emotional background is, and also get to really get into the kung fu world, because now that he got into it, I mean, how can we push it even further? So that was one of the big things we wanted to do in the sequel, to make sure that it was a deeper experience than the first one. And we got to do that because you know the characters and you get to see the complexity in them.
I mean, one of the things that struck me in the first film was that the real focus of that was on the idea of Poe being this outsider who is rapidly indoctrinated into this world. And now, having done that, I think one of the things that I found fascinating about Kung Fu Panda 2 was that there was a stronger embrace on the idea of this being a Kung Fu film, and in particular in the Hong Kong Jackie Chan mold. How much did you work to getting it that way? What did you want to do in that regard?
Well, as I was mentioning, Poe just barely got to some sort of kung fu skills at the end of the first movie. And, you know, everybody that works on the film is really a fan of martial arts movies. And we're not making a parody of a martial arts movie. We're trying to go into that in as cool and liberated a way as we could get in animated media. And also our kung fu choreographer, Rodolphe Gennadin, who worked on the first film as well, doing that. The opportunities of having Poe doing kung fu was something we barely got to explore in the first film. So in the sequel, we wanted to make sure we made things challenging for him, for Poe, mm-hmm. and trying to find ways of making things just as exciting for him without losing his geekness. And there's plenty to places to go in a world of this scale to make sure things are challenging for him, but also allowing him to explore his skill set.
I think one of the things that struck me about, too, is that there is, I think, a greater emphasis on the idea of the battle scenes being thematic, very much in the mold of a Jackie Chan film. And I'm sort of presuming that there's only so much that you can do in the scripting phase with that sort of concept. How much of it got written down on the page? How much of it had to be worked out during the storyboarding? I don't know how much you can improvise in this regard, but how much of it came out in the actual manipulation of the characters?
In the case of the martial arts fighting, you can't write it in. You just can't. I mean, you have to know what the intent of it is, what the upshot of what the point of it is, because otherwise it's confetti. But after that, it's really left up to the story artists and the animators to figure out what's going to happen. What we often do is we have brainstorming sessions going, well, what would be cool in this section? If you know the objective is this and the character is trying to do this, what could we do? And we have a fabulous group of story artists would sit and brainstorm it on a whiteboard. Someone would go and board it. We would do a board of it that's very meticulous because of the complexity involved. We would have even sometimes do some previs trying to get some of the sets involved with layout. And we would also get the animators involved. Right off what I mentioned before would be making sure that the animators had very, very specific kung fu moves that are accurate that they could animate. And then the animators are given a great deal of freedom to make sure that we get something very cool. And I think that's the crux of it, that every step of the way, people aren't just told, you know, do what is said here and just stick to it. They're required to think about it and add what they can to it every single step. And that's why the nuances in some of these action beats, you just can't get if you just paraphrase it in a paragraph. It's tiny things that happen. If you slow it down, you will see all sorts of things that are added by a lot of people.
You know, it's a smaller moment. It's not one of the major battle scenes, but I think one of the places where it really paid off was the sequence in the jail where the good guys are trying to convince the imprisoned bodyguards to join them in their fight. And there is a tussle that's built around the jail door where I think you use just about every sort of permutation of pivot and leverage that you can with that door. How did that sequence get developed?
Well, certainly something like that. I mean, it's based off the idea of Jackie Chan using a prop to make a really cool action scene that's comedic, and that's kind of one of the thematic things we try to get in all these action moments. But that particular sequence is pretty difficult because all we had essentially was the objective. Poe wants them out, and they want to stay in. And then we had the story artist, Joel Crawford, go off and think of something. And he thought of something. Boarded it up, worked with Rodolph as well, and they just brainstormed it with that story. And they just came up with it. And it was one of the last sequences that made it into the movie. And it just was so simple and funny what they could just do with a door. And we also had to sit and look at the door and go, all right, how can we hinge this thing so it works? We built it to be able to do all that stuff. Because you have to plan everything ahead of time. You have to make sure the set is designed to do all that stuff physically. And luckily, it worked out to be a really funny moment.
I don't know how tangible those props become within the computer. Did the door reveal anything once it was actually built and implemented?
Yes, because we're like looking at the set, and if you look at the size of the characters, Poe and a croc and an ox, and imagine fitting them on the backs of a door and how wide this door would have to be in order for them to actually clear the top or bottom of this thing. We had to do a little bit of cheating, but mostly it's quite accurate. Those characters can fit in that door, and we had to make sure that that door was big enough for them to be doing all the flips.
Tell me a little bit about the development of Lord Shen. It's, you know, in a film that has a lot of beautifully designed characters, he's especially beautiful. But tell me about his development and also then how that played into his fighting style.
Well, certainly we wanted to go in the completely opposite version of the villains in the first movie, Tai Lung, because you can't repeat yourself. I mean, Tai Lung was a very brute force. He was awesome, and you can't really just make another guy that punches harder, you know. So we needed to go for an opposite idea, and the idea of a peacock actually was batting around when the writers were thinking about potential ideas for the first film and the second film. And we never got to use the peacock in the first film. In the second film, they had proposed this kind of more cerebral villain with technology, and so he doesn't have to be as physically imposing. He's just simply smarter. So we were batting that idea around, and initially everybody was like, wait, peacock? Seriously? And we were trying to figure out, well, how to make this guy really cool and scary, because sometimes the sort of skinny, devious villains are the scariest villains. And if you look at Gary Oldman, he's not a physically imposing guy, but he was probably one of the scariest villains ever in a lot of this film. And so Nico, the character designer, went and made almost a Nosferatu-shaped villain and went for a very simplistic silhouette where he could be hunched and kind of vampire-like. And Rodolph, the choreographer, would try to find a completely unique way for him to move for his martial arts. It's not something that you would easily be able to defend against. And he looked at rhythmic gymnastics and some of the extreme contortions that those people do were very useful for a bird's physique. So we looked at that. And also at the same time, we're looking at a voice that would give that layer of threat to somebody who's very unexpected. And so Gary Oldman was the first and only consideration for the voice. And all those things came together while we were working on a great sort of a real backstory for him. And during that whole process, it took a long time because he's a fantastically complicated rig. Physically, he was incredibly hard to create. For about a year, a bunch of people just were trying to make sure that this guy could move and do some of these moves that Rodolph had sketched out on paper. And in the end, when we put it all together, we got Shen.
And it of course, it makes sense that he would be using his tail feathers, his plumage, in his fighting style. And yet I felt that in particular the way it was deployed here was pretty damn credible as a fighting style. Did that take long to develop?
Yes, it took a while. I mean, everything that we do, because of course it's all made up, animation, everything in it has to be created. So you have to weigh it down with things that are tactically real so that you don't just go, well, it's just fake, you know. You have to make it actually more believable than a live-action production. So when the idea for all these moves that that Shen could do was being thought of, Rodolph actually sat and did traditional hand-drawn pencil sketches of how this guy could move his tail, and we brainstormed it and came up with how the tail could split in half and sweep and have this level of flexibility. And then it was really up to those poor souls that had to figure out how to make a 2D, 3D rig do that, because it's very complicated. But we always grounded it in something real, because otherwise you go, well, that tail is magic and it can do whatever it wants. And that's not very good for fight sequences with a real threat and real stakes involved.
Mm-hmm. Was there, for all that this is about talking animals in a fantasy China, how important was it to ground it in a physical reality?
Very, very. As I was mentioning, it's more important and more of sort of, it has to happen that you believe what's going on. And the more fake you have it, the more you have to make someone believe that it's really going on. If you have a completely fake created world and a fake set and fake creatures running around doing fake things, then it's very easy to just stop and go, well, I'm just watching a cartoon. And you will emotionally disinvest yourself from what's going on. So we had to work 10 times as hard trying to make sure that every time someone gets hit, it looks like they actually get hit. Or if someone leaps off a building, they could die if they hit the ground. And otherwise, you just will think that you're watching, you know, some big performance. And it also goes to the set design. We had to make sure these places looked more real than what you would normally have to put into a real live-action set. We had to make sure you believe this completely fabricated place is someplace that you could walk around in and touch.
You know, it's here again, it's not unusual for a CG animated film to go over into other formats for different sequences. And the first film, you did do the dream sequence. The opening sequence was a 2D animated thing. I think it's a little unusual what gets done in Kung Fu Panda 2 in that you incorporate several different formats. There's a shadow puppet format that you use for the prologue. The flashback sequences are used in 2D. Was there any concern about going to all those different formats? And how did the looks of each of those formats, how were they shaped?
Well, sorry, there was some concern about confusing people with too many different versions of it, but it was important to differentiate PoVision, which is that 2D style that you saw in the first film, which is what Po sees in his head, with a flashback, which is really the story of the villain of the movie. And we don't want to make it look like Po is some omniscient character that knows the story of the villain of the movie. So we had to separate the two. And that's why in this one, even though we kept the language of Po's mind, his 2D mind that we use for his personal flashbacks, the villain flashback, which is the shadow puppets, we had to come up with something totally different. And one of the ideas, it came from the production designer and the art director, Ramon Zeebach and Tang Heng. They came up with traditional Chinese shadow puppets and how to do that in an animated version of that, so we simulate those hands that are doing the shadow puppet. And they came up with a look for it, and it was just really different. I hadn't seen anything quite like that before, and thought it was just a really nice way of expanding the world.
So, is there now a Kung Fu Panda 3 in the work? Will you be moving on to that?
Well, I just got back from vacation.
Where'd you go? No, never mind.
First 3 days back, and I'm like getting my desk back together and remembering what it's like to eat food here.
I understand it's pretty good over there.
It's very good. Like, oh, I can eat their yummy paninis. So, give me time.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rush you.
certainly, if there is more, it'd be really cool.
Okay. Jennifer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great chat.
My pleasure.
As I mentioned, Kung Fu Panda 2 is now available on home video. That includes DVD, Blu-ray, Amazon Instant View, Netflix disc rental. Hey, it's everywhere. Give it a shot. I've got the trailer and the link to the official website at mightymoviepodcast.com if you want to check out more. And If you want to write me, that email address is dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. And it'll be a little slow this January with MMP, but I'm working to line stuff up, and hopefully we'll have something in the next couple of weeks. Keep your eyes and ears peeled. Thanks for listening. Have fun. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2012, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.